Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Gemma, and welcome to another episode of Good Influence. This is the podcast where I welcome our guests to discuss their experiences, answer your questions, and teach us something new. This week, we're talking about stress and resilience, the difference between stress and anxiety, managing stresses that we can't get rid of, and how we adapt and recover after particularly tough times. So, joining me this week is Dr. Sam Akbar. Sam is a clinical psychologist, trauma specialist, and, as will make perfect sense now you've heard the theme for this week's episode, is also the author of a book called Stressilient: How to Beat Stress and Build Resilience. She also founded newsletter The Mindful Minute, providing busy women with quick and practical tools to help them manage their stress and feel happier. So we're going to talk about stress today. Well, stress and resilience, but let's start with stress. How, as a professional person, would you define stress, and how is it different from, say, when we might talk about something like anxiety?
Okay. So I think stress is when you feel like you cannot cope with the demands being placed on you. Like your ability, you feel that your ability to cope with things or manage things is beyond what your coping skills are. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's how I'd think about stress. I'd say anxiety is, I would describe that as more as how you feel in your body. Mm-hmm. And so you can be stressed without being anxious, I think.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you can be stressed without being anxious. Anxiety is a part of a response maybe to something you perceive as frightening, and your heart races and your muscles clench and all the fight or flight response. And along with that comes with a constellation of thoughts about anxiety. So I'd see them as different that way. Anxiety could be a response to stress, but not necessarily.
Interesting. Yeah, because I mean, that was kind of a place I wanted to start, because when I think about the word stress, I feel like it kind of has different forms immediately in my head, because I think, you know, day to day we might think about stress and it might be, you know, I've had a stressful day at the end of the day is something you might say, and people can kind of imagine that feeling for themselves. But in terms of you as being somebody who works on stress kind of like clinically and medically, as you say, thinking about anxiety, I kind of know what that feels like in my body, and I think I could kind of list sort of symptoms of that. But thinking about stress, that is quite a different feeling. So when it comes to kind of diagnosing someone with stress, how exactly do you go about that?
Well, I guess I would think more in terms of anxiety in inverted commas disorders rather than stress disorders. So actually what I spend most of my clinical time doing is working on post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
But what I've written about more generally is feeling stress in everyday life. So how would you, I wouldn't say, oh, you know, you're a bit stressed, you need this. I'd be looking for more like, well, what is the anxiety here? It could be PTSD, or it could be OCD, it could be generalized anxiety disorder. There are lots of different anxiety disorders. Mm-hmm. And they follow a pattern of how you might feel in your body, or how you might think about things, or what things you might avoid. I guess what I would say more generally about stress is, I think you could, for example, I would say I can go on holiday and maybe not be stressed, but I can feel anxious. Right. And maybe some people feel it vice versa. So actually, I suppose it depends where my mind goes, put it like that. So I think that I would, in terms of sort of diagnosing, in as much as psychologists diagnose, I think the difference I would make is that anxiety is, there's sort of categories of anxiety that we know about, where stress, I think, is something, a sort of catch-all that we use more generally for, there's a lot going on in my life and I can't cope with it.
Yeah. So, I mean, how do you start to work on stress if it's things like, because what I would imagine is, you know, if you're talking to someone and you realize, you know, they've got a lot of stress in their life that they feel they're not coping with, I feel like a lot of immediate advice, I guess, that you would probably get is things like, you know, what's the circumstance that's causing you stress? Change the circumstance, kind of. But how do we start to deal with stress when you can't change the source of the stress? So, I mean, and then my mind immediately goes to things like long-term illness, or, you know, things like someone's living situation that they wouldn't be able to immediately change. How do those longer-term sources of stress, how do we start to deal with those?
Completely. Well, the first thing I think, and I sort of say it at the top of my book, which is, I can't get rid of stress for you.
Mm-hmm.
And no one else can either. If you think about, life is full of stressful situations that are often out of our control. And often things can seem stressful. You know, you could be doing, right, Gemma, you could be doing a big event. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot to prepare for, and it's taking up loads of your time. And then you've got like some, you know, you've got to go and see some family member, or you've got a friend who's in crisis. Like, there's a lot of stress, right? That's not to say you would not want to do your big event, right? You'd still want to go off and do it, but there could be just lots of things going on. So I can't, and you wouldn't want to get rid of all of those things out of your life. They are part of life. So I can't get rid of stress, and I don't think anyone can get rid of it. And I think part of it is about expectation. So the problem, I think, comes when there are these events that we can't control and that are part of sometimes of living life, a rich and meaningful life. So I will always feel a bit stressed, like, is my dad okay? Is my daughter okay? And I wouldn't take that away because I love them and that's part of my life. So I can't get rid of that. I think that the problem comes when you start thinking, I should not feel this way. I don't want to feel this way.
Right.
Or I shouldn't be thinking like this, or you start getting really caught up with, I can't cope with it, I'll never manage, I'm not a person who can manage, oh, it's all going to go wrong. And you get stuck in certain patterns of thinking. And then alongside that, maybe you are starting to feel quite anxious or having lots of difficult feelings in your body, whatever feelings they are, and you start trying to push them away.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the questions, I guess, that you might come to when you've got a really difficult life situation is, rather than saying to yourself, what can I do to stop feeling this way, is to ask yourself, what am I willing to feel in order to live the kind of life I want? So can I make room for these really difficult feelings?
Yeah.
Instead of saying, how do I stop feeling this way? And that, for me, is quite a fundamental shift in how you relate to how you think about things or feel about things.
Definitely. I mean, hearing you kind of ask that question, and I think it's quite a difficult question. I mean, straight off the bat, I mean, we're not sat in a therapy session where I'm having therapy about something I'm stressed about. But I think that it definitely would be quite a big reframing for me, I think, to kind of look at those feelings of stress around a situation and kind of say, what am I willing to feel? I guess the example you gave of, you know, say you were stressed or anxious about a big event coming up sort of thing. That, I guess, is an example of, well, I'm willing to feel that level of stress because,
yeah,
that, you know, I want to do the thing. Like, that's what the outcome's going
to
be.
Or I'm willing to make room for anxiety, or I'm willing to make, or maybe you mentioned about having a long-term illness.
Mm-hmm.
Quite often it might be about, so the clients I work with are refugees with post-traumatic stress disorder who survived mm-hmm. torture, sexual violence or war. So their lives are not as they once were.
Yeah.
And there are really, as you would expect, very difficult feelings and emotions that come up. And I think some of the work that we do around that is asking, in the face of this awful suffering
mm-hmm.
that you did not choose, in which you were a victim, you didn't want this, didn't ask for this, what kind of person do you want to be in the face of this suffering?
Mm-hmm.
Because that gives you, what are your values? What values do you want to show in the face of your suffering, both to yourself and to others and to the world? And that's a different reframe as well. It's about saying, well, this thing has happened and I can't change it. How do I want to be in the face of this suffering, this really difficult moment? You might, maybe you're if you're caring for an elderly parent or a relative, maybe that's something you're going to have to do. So how do you want to do it? How do you want to conduct yourself? What are the values you want to bring in the way that you care for that person? Does that make sense? Like, you can kind of bring to those interactions a kind of quality. So do I want to go, all right, love, mum, here's your cup of tea, I'm out the door now, God, what a burden you are. Or do you want to sort of, come and sort of say, well, actually, the things that are important to me are just showing love or kindness or playfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And how can I bring that into those interactions? Because that's something you are in control of. You're not in control of often situations around you, but you are in control of what you say and what you do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like there's so many, obviously you're talking about the work that you do, particularly with refugees and PTSD in particular. Another example we just talked about is, maybe illness in your family, or whether that's your own illness. These are obviously things that they're very different circumstances. And we might also talk about people who don't have that kind of level of impactful sort of, it might be lower level stresses
sure.
that are kind of day-to-day things, and we all have different combinations of those that
sure.
come up at different times. Are there different ways to approach those different types of stress, if you like, or is it generally the same?
For me, I feel like it's the same.
Mm-hmm.
Whether you're looking at something really huge in your life, or it's, I've had a really bad week and lots of very difficult things have happened, I would say, because I do a lot of these techniques on myself, I'd say whether I've had a really just kind of lots of low-level stress over the week or a really big problem, I'm doing the similar things.
Yeah.
And so I think what I like about the approach I write about in my book is it feels for me universal, that these are things you can use with low-level stress and high-level stress.
Okay, so let's talk about your book. So Stressilient, obviously we're talking about stress, and I did say we'll move on and also talk about resilience is obviously the other half of Stressilient as a term.
One of my made up words. Yeah.
Well, I love a made up word personally, so I'm into it. Could you talk to us a little bit about the role of resilience and its kind of relationship to stress? Is that the response to the stress in your view?
So it's all about kind of how you define things, right? So some people would say, well, resilience is oh, you never show emotion and you just, you think positively and you toughen up and on you get with it. Lifestyle.
Toxic positivity, stoicism.
Toxic positivity, I know. Good vibes only.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that's one way of people thinking what resilience is. For me, that isn't what it is at all. And I think lots of people would agree with me on this, I think, is that resilience isn't about never feeling the emotions or never having difficult thoughts or never getting knocked down. It's about accepting that you do get knocked down and using good skills and techniques to get back up again. So, and that will happen repeatedly. Right? Unfortunately, if only we could say I've had my one bit of bad luck in life and that's it. And now I get back up and I'm done.
That way, does it?
Sadly doesn't work that way. So resilience for me is about making room for all the difficult things that you feel when you go through a really hard time and learning to manage your mind better in those times. And to, even in the face of that, to kind of be able to act in line with your values. That to me is resilience. So the resilience is not that you never get knocked down. Resilience is that you are able to get back up again.
Okay, and so what kind of tools do you discuss either with, you know, patients or clients or whatever your preferred term would be? And kind of in the book, what are some of those tools and coping mechanisms that you would suggest to people?
Okay, so I guess I sort of, there are a few main things. So the first is, that I think is most helpful, is before you really start undertaking that, the first thing is a little bit of understanding how your mind works. And I wish I had known this when I was like 25. So how your mind works is that it's just in gear for fear. It's there to spot threats. It's there to feel like there's danger around every corner. And I used to think that this was a very abnormal thing.
Yeah,
but it isn't. It's actually how you're built. In evolutionary terms, it makes sense to pay attention to danger in the environment.
Sure.
Okay. The other part that's really important to know is that your brain has the capability to feel very fearful and then think about things that will happen in the future that might go wrong, as well as having the great ability to ruminate on what you've done wrong in the past. So you've got this kind of reptilian brain, which is sort of looks for danger everywhere, plus your sort of more recently evolved brain that can sort of think about things. So it can judge your feelings, often negatively. Oh my God, why are you feeling so anxious? What a loser you are. And it can think back to previous events. It could say, well, God, last time you tried to do that, well, it went wrong, didn't it? I mean, do you remember why it went wrong? So you're in a conversation, rather insane conversation. And we all are. It's the other thing. Everyone is doing it.
Which is so comforting to know.
It is so comforting, isn't it? And I feel like as a mental health professional, it is helpful to say, these things happen to me. I found that very reassuring when I was training. And I heard people say, no, it's not that I don't have my own things.
Yeah.
I'm not sitting here with a big cigar and a glass of whiskey going, I'm so never stressed.
I love that.
Never have any problems whatsoever. Though I'd love you to think that is absolutely not true. Especially if you could see the pile of washing I'm probably sitting in.
I mean, that's highly relatable as far as I'm concerned.
So, you know, kind of that idea that we're all doing it. We're all thinking about, obsessing about the future, ruminating about the past, catastrophizing, and our brains are built to do that. And I wish I'd known that earlier, because I used to think, why can't I just, I really remember having this thought. Well, I must have been in my mid-20s, which is, why am I not happy all the time?
Oh my God, yes.
Did you have that?
I mean, so this is the thing. I will relate to this a lot as well. And it's kind of throughout most of my 20s, to be honest, the kind of like ups and downs that I've had through depression and anxiety. Yeah. And like, well, but depression particularly in that sense is kind of going through different sort of treatments and kind of being on antidepressants in the past. And like those questions do really come up. And it's kind of like, what is the goal? And is it to feel okay? Or I think often kind of more towards the beginning, when you just feel quite sad all the time, the aim is to kind of feel happy all the time. And I feel like, you know, the further you get through life, I think it is one of those things that annoyingly people say, you know, this kind of the wisdom that comes with age is you realize that that is never gonna happen, to be happy all the time. And if you stop aiming for it, it's so much easier.
Completely, isn't it? It's so counterintuitive. Stop trying to be happier and you might be happier.
Yeah,
but somewhere along the line we have grown up thinking that's what will happen. And it's a shock then. You're not going to be happy all the time.
Yeah, I think the less you expect or aim to be happy as a consistent state, the more I have found that you appreciate the times that you are happy.
Yes, and I think how you define happiness is really important. So there are different kinds of happiness. And do you feel, I think what I felt, maybe we all do when younger, is what you're craving is that kind of high happiness, that sort of hedonistic happiness of being in a club and you're with all your friends and you're having a great time. And, you know, that has a, well, maybe it's not true, but it probably has a time stamp on it. Like it doesn't go on forever. But then loads of people are now going to ring in and say, oh, no, it does. And you're just sad and don't go out anymore, which is also entirely true.
Again, highly relatable.
So I guess there's that kind of happiness. And then there's a kind of contentment happiness. I think the real kind of pitfall is thinking that it's not normal to feel any other way.
Yeah.
And I think that's where it's useful to know that your brain is kind of evolved to be a bit negative.
Yeah.
Makes sense. And I think that would have really helped me. And that's one of the things that I really write about in the book, because I think it's such a useful starting point. So how are you built? How is your brain built? So that's one thing I think is helpful in that idea of resilience. The second thing I wrote about is kind of how you can think better. And that doesn't mean having more positive thoughts by any means, because that isn't the answer, right? The more you try to not think about something negative, the more it will bounce back in your face.
Yeah, the whole don't think about a pink elephant thing, right?
Yes, yes. I'm sort of into white bears. So that's my thing. I go for the white bear, but pink elephants, you know, whatever you like, whatever funny coloured animal you like, you can do it with. So, you know, the idea that you try and push that pink elephant away and not think about it, it will come back not only more frequently, but also with more intensity. So the more you try to say, oh, you know, I'm not struggling, the more it's going to bounce back more. Yeah. And the answer to that actually isn't to stand in front of the mirror doing your like, I'm awesome face. Because it doesn't work effectively. Sometimes it does. And, you know, some people find that helpful, but I think it's problematic if that's your only thing. For me, and the way I approach it, the way to manage it better is to change your relationship with those thoughts. And so you look not at whether they're true or not, and you don't try and outrun them with your positivity, because your brain is always is cleverer than you are. It's going to get the better of you. The answer for me is to learn to see those thoughts for what they are. They are thoughts that go through your mind, and to acknowledge them as such. So, you know, to treat the thought, I'm a massive loser, in the same way that you might treat, I need to buy printer ink.
Okay.
And that feels like a massive leap for people, but I can honestly tell you, I feel like that ability to change how you relate to your thoughts really helps people. Mm-hmm. So if I asked you, if you want to do an example, do you want to do an example?
Sure.
Okay. So if I ask you to come up, or whoever's listening, right, come up with a thought that really bugs you. One, pick a judgment about yourself. So my quite frequent one is I'm a failure. That kind of thing.
Oh my God. I mean, I love you so much already. I hate even hearing that you think that about yourself. okay. So mine would be, okay, one that I really struggle with, and I'm probably going off topic already, but I have slightly struggled less with, but still, is the fact that I'm lazy.
Okay.
Which is now like very tied to what I now know is ADHD, but that's something that I really beat myself up for. And if I know that I've got things to do and kind of just get a bit overwhelmed by it and end up doing none of it, it's the thought that I'm lazy that I really struggle with.
Okay, so I mustn't nickname you Lazy Bones then.
Absolutely not, thank you very much.
All right, so Gemma, just really bring up that thought, I'm lazy, for you. Just really get it up in your face, really think, you know, that I have got so much to do, I'm not getting it done, I'm lazy. So I really want you to feel like it's there.
Oh yeah, I'm very uncomfortable right now.
Are you uncomfortable? I'm so pleased. That's what we like in therapy. Okay, great. So you're uncomfortable. I'm delighted. So you're thinking I'm lazy. Okay, so really buy into that. Now I just want you to, instead of saying I'm lazy, you just say, I'm having the thought I'm lazy.
Okay, yeah.
What does that do to that thought? I'm lazy. I'm having the thought I'm lazy.
I feel like it would suddenly kind of remove it from me.
To distance?
It's kind of, yeah. It feels like, this is very therapy-esque, but it felt like it was right in my chest, and now it kind of feels like it's about 20 centimetres in front of me.
Love it. Okay, so there's a bit of distance from you. Okay.
Yeah.
So now if you want to go a bit Jedi level, you ready? You ready?
Oh, I don't know. Let's see, shall we?
You ready to kind of really go into your deep Jedi training now?
Yep, I'm ready.
Okay, all right. Take it a step further by saying, I'm noticing I'm having a thought that I'm lazy.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and now suddenly I'm a person who's in control because I'm aware of the situation. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, does that feel like it sort of goes a bit further away even more? I'm noticing, I can just notice that I have that thought.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd say it feels like a little bit more cerebral in nature rather than...
Okay, yes, so more meta.
Judgmental. Yeah, like I'm now... Okay, so if we said it's moved in front of me, now you're kind of like looking down at it.
Okay, so there's more distance.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say you're having that thought, I'm lazy, and you have got loads of things to do, right? When you've got that distance, does it make it more or less likely you could engage in the things now that you need to get done?
More, for sure. Right. Yeah, I can see that already. And it does, it kind of, I feel like I talked about this in maybe quite a different way when I did therapy some years ago, and that was something that was very much geared towards kind of anxiety. So rather than even being thoughts about myself, it would be, you know, kind of worrying about XYZ thing happening, and that kind of like thought labeling as an exercise, as we discussed I did find helpful, and I think that it makes a lot of sense to me only by experience. That being able to, and I mean, it doesn't always, and it's not like you learn this thing and you can always do it instantly. But being able to kind of look at a thought and be like, almost kind of like writing a list of what thoughts you're having, takes them off you.
Yeah, exactly. And there are different ways of doing things, but the aim is always to see it as thoughts They're not directives. They're not commandments carved in stone, right? These, even these really painful judgments about ourselves, can we treat them as, you know, I'm lazy and I've got to stop at Tesco on the way home? You know, it's that kind of level of, can we learn? And honestly, it sounds so impossible. And I remember when I first kind of learned about this, I was like, oh my God, if I'm not my thoughts, who am I?
Oh God, okay, kind of worse.
Yeah, and I was like, I remember being on a plane to Trinidad. I almost wanted to jump up in the aisles and go, ah! Oh, is anyone, see, that, do people stress, know this?
That sounds very stressful.
But I think it's just about sort of beginning to, and as you practice it more, you begin to see, okay, oh, hey, my brain is off on one today.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely, I'm, wow. It's really got something to say about this today. Whereas before, I think previously, I would have really got caught up in that. And now it's not like it makes me feel good, but I can say, okay, is this, is it helped me to get really caught up in that?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, so I guess, you know, that is one technique I cover that I really like, but there are lots of others in the book about kind of having this different relationship with your thinking, not just to kind of get rid of it, but so you can do what's important because you've got this space to do that. So that's one. So I guess it's managing your mind, having a different relationship with your thoughts. And then the other part, I think, well, there are various parts, but the other thing that I think we've touched on a little bit already, but is important, is that idea of emotions and how you can feel better. And what I mean by feel better is how can you experience your emotions or have a relationship with your emotions rather than just feel good things.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, I'm one of those people that only wants to be happy. I don't like feeling sad. It's just, I could possibly be in the wrong job. I don't know what's giving me that clue right now. I try and be open about that because I think it's helpful to hear that other people find, even professionals find emotions really difficult. Yeah, I'm not sitting around going, oh, sadness, come to me. I can make space for you. I'm like, I'll hide under a blanket till it's all gone away sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what is helpful is to learn that you can make room for those really difficult emotions. They won't kill you. I think I might honestly have once believed emotions could finish you off.
Right.
And it does feel like that, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You do feel sometimes really intense emotion feels incredibly uncomfortable.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's making me think of, you know, you're kind of saying you don't want to be sad. It's making me think about TV. I mean, a lot of things make me think about TV.
Me too.
So I'm someone who I wouldn't go and watch a sad film for fun. Like I don't, and I, again, maybe that's the depression experience. I'm not in the habit of attracting sad feelings into my life. However, probably my most common and worst catchphrase that drives my boyfriend up the wall is that I like watching kind of drama and thrillery kind of TV shows, but I sit there while I'm watching it saying, this is so stressful. This is so stressful. And I say it all the time. But that's obviously stress that I'm, you know, willingly putting myself under. So it's all
But I guess you're in control of it.
Yes. So that's the kind of thing where, yeah, you look at it, and that's why I think it's really interesting to talk about these kind of coping mechanisms as well, because most of the stress that comes into our life, we don't ask for.
No. So what do you do with that then?
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's why I think that this conversation will hopefully be helpful, and kind of the stuff that you can't get rid of, how do you deal with that? Because I do think it's quite common in the kind of like mental health, anxiety especially sort of conversation. And people who don't understand depression very well will also use this for depression and kind of act as if everything is situational, and by changing your circumstances or environment or situation, act like that's really easy. And what we should be aiming for is to kind of, oh, well, that thing's causing you stress, we'll just get rid of it then. And that isn't how life works. And I think that's why I'm grateful to you for, you know, speaking to us today. And how do you face those things head on rather than just, you know, pretending they're not happening?
Yeah. And you could try and control those things, couldn't you? But it could potentially quite curtail your life. Mm. And actually, what do you do? Because if you want to have relationships with other people in any way,
yeah,
there will always be times when some of those relationships will entail stress or challenges. Yeah. So I think one of the things that, you know, could talk about is making, you know, thinking about what am I willing to feel in order to live the kind of life I want? So what difficult emotions am I willing to feel? And how can I learn to make room for those? Yep. And some of that, there's some practices in there about how you kind of are able to do that and how you can kind of see yourself. I like this way of thinking it as a place where emotions happen, but not that you are that emotion. So I've been bleating on the last podcast I was on about this, so it's all, you know, over my Instagram feed, but it's this idea that I like that you're the sky and your emotions are the weather, and sometimes it's sunny and sometimes there's a tornado, but you're not harmed as the sky by those emotions. You can make room for that. And sometimes I think some of these things sound a bit cheesy, I get it, but actually when you start to think like that, it is really quite liberating.
Yeah, no, and I love that. And that was, I actually shared part of that clip onto Instagram stories when I was asking our listeners to send in questions for you.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously people were sending in questions, but some people were just replying to that story saying, I love the way that she's talking about that. I think that is a really powerful thing to, I think, remind me.
No one said I had a bad hair day. I was having a very bad hair day. That's what I'm more worried about. That's my stress.
No, nobody said that. Nobody said that. Okay. But yeah, it was.
I was just having a thought then. I was having a bad hair day. Maybe I should do that.
Stressing about it. Just take it away from you. But I think that's kind of a nice place to, you know, end this section before we move on to Q&A. I thought that was a really nice way of looking at it, as in, the sky is still there and it's fine after that weather has passed. I think it's almost quite a common piece of imagery that people talk about in terms of mental health, the whole kind of like stormy skies thing. And you understand why, because I think you talk about stormy skies and most people can kind of connect an emotion to that. But yeah, I thought it was a quite different way of looking at it, the way that you were phrasing it.
I think it's about just changing your relationship a bit with your thoughts and your emotions, so that you can show the kind of values that are important to you. And that's, I guess, the third really important part of things, is being able to, why are you doing all this? Not to chase happiness always, but to show that to show yourself that you can act in line with what's important to you, and maybe using that as a barometer of happiness rather than a internal state. So I feel full of the joys that I would feel if I were dancing barefoot on a beach in Goa. Mm-hmm. Maybe occasionally swapping that out for, you know, today I had an interaction with someone and I displayed the values that are important to me.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Every week, my guest and I will be answering your questions, and the first one comes in from Louise, who says, I sometimes feel like stress defines my whole life. When I'm stressed at work or at school, I can't seem to relax at home. And when I'm too stressed and have a huge to-do list, my body or mind tends to do a complete shutdown. Even basic hygiene seems like a huge task at this point, and I tend to skip it. So my question is, do you have any tips for a healthy way to cope with stress and how to avoid those shutdowns?
Gosh, poor Louise, that sounds like you're under a lot of stress if even kind of basic things of looking after yourself are falling
away. I have to say, when I read that question, that sounds more like burnout than stress to me.
So I feel like, that's you're heading quite hard into not looking after yourself. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it's those things that fall, you know, sleep, eating well, fall out of the our repertoire very quickly. What I would say to Louise is actually, where is there room? What can she control at home and at school or wherever she's working to reduce some of those things? So what situations can she change? Yes. Where can she ask for help?
Yeah.
Okay. So she's got so much to do. That's the other thing. I think one, I wonder whether she might find another book helpful, which is called 4,000 Weeks by Oliver Berkman, which is basically, it's brilliant. And it's not so much about stress management. It's more about kind of how we will never get it all done.
Yeah.
You will never get it all done. And I wonder if Louise is, and I might be wrong, I don't know, but she feels like there's so many things to do. And they have to all be done, or at least, or even done well. What are the things that can be ditched?
Yeah.
Where and those things that can be ditched, as long as no one dies, they can be ditched.
Sure.
It feels like they can't, but she's so at the edge of kind of being able to cope with that right now. There's just hasn't even got time to really look after her basic needs. And then she's shutting down because she's exhausted. And as you say, it sounds like she's burning out. So I think trying to, get some help, right? Number one, I think this is a lot for her to deal with on her own.
Yeah.
Whether she gets that professionally or speaks to someone about where is there wiggle room to reduce some of the things that are hot on her plate. Because I think she has it would help her if she could reduce some of that. And then when she can reduce some of that, then she can start managing the other stuff a bit better. But I think the first thing I would do if I were her is just try what can come off my plate? Yeah. And start prioritizing some of her really basic needs.
Yeah. Thank you for that. I hope that is helpful to Louise and anyone else who might feel in a similar situation. It's one of these things. It's difficult, isn't it, when it's you are a doctor, but we're talking on a podcast, so it can't be as super specific. But I love, quite frankly, that I'm able to pass on some of these questions, because sometimes it's that might be the first step to
absolutely
to being able to sort of see that help is needed. So I hope that was helpful. Next question is from Teresa, and she says this question is about her daughter, who is 17. And she says, my daughter, while she's a kick-ass independent girl, her resilience is close to zero. She gives up and crumbles whenever things get too tough, and I find it really heartbreaking. My question is, how do I support her through this? She's always been like it, and it's only getting worse with A-levels and her driving test coming up.
I think maybe helping her draw out the times when she has got through things. And so there will be times when she's crumbled, but how has she got through them?
Mm-hmm.
And to help her kind of start trusting in her own strengths. And they will be there, but she can't see them. So just, I think one of the things might be to go back over the last few years and just try and work out where have there been times when she's felt more capable. And what was, you know, what did she do that helped her feel more capable? Mm-hmm. What was she thinking? What was she feeling? And just helping her really kind of hone in on some of those occasions where she has been more resilient. So she can kind of take control of that narrative that I'm not resilient.
Yeah.
And going forward to help her keep building that up. I'd be interested to know, or what this the lady could ask, is whether do other people come to her rescue a bit to help her out of that as well? And whether, you know, how can she take more control of the situation? So she's got A levels and her driving test coming up. Now, some of that will be about, well, how do we plan that things are happening in a way that aren't overwhelming? But also, how can she start to change the story that I'm someone who can't cope? And the way to change that is by doing things that prove to yourself that you can cope.
Yeah.
Yeah. So some behavioral experiments, we'd call them, about doing things that I can cope more than I think I can. I could.
Yeah, God, that's such an interesting answer. I think, yeah, that is, I mean, I think I've definitely had the tendency in times where I've been like, oh, I can't, you know, I'm sensitive, I can't cope with this sorts of thing. And I do, I feel like that's the first thing, you know, therapists will tell you is
you don't can't avoid do the it,
thing, because that just teaches you that you're right and you can't do it. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much for that. Last question is from Matilda, who says, when you go through prolonged periods of stress, i.e. for me, surviving the pandemic, while first time parenting to twins born in spring 2020, do you need to do more to recover, or will you be able to weather the storms and eventually just move on from a hard time? Can people be permanently damaged by very stressful events?
What does she, I suppose it depends what you mean by permanently damaged, right?
Yeah.
So I think, will you always feel that you went through a definite time? Yes. But what does it mean to be permanently damaged by an event? What does it mean? Does it mean you don't function in the same way? Does it mean that you feel you're different? The answer to that question is a bit tricky, because it's quite an idiosyncratic answer depending on that person. Mm-hmm. What she has been through, an enormously big stress, and I wonder if she does feel quite permanently changed by that. One thing I think is really helpful is to maybe go back and think about that time, break it into sections and write about it, and help yourself process what you went through. Mm. I really do think there's a lot to be said in that, because you can look through, you can write back and think about how you thought about things then, how you think about that now, how you're making sense of that now. Maybe there mm-hmm. are more strengths there than you realize. But just, I think that is quite a useful exercise to do when you've been through a really traumatic, stressful experience, is to write about what happened in quite a lot of detail. Mm-hmm. And I hope that, think that helps you make sense of your emotions. She might also be interested to read about post-traumatic growth, because actually lots of people, yes, maybe they do feel they're changed forever, but a lot of people feel that they grow in a more positive way because of their traumas. They find out something about themselves. They find out what they were able to cope with or what they couldn't cope with, but they learn something and they take that forward. So she might want to have a Google of post-traumatic growth if she feels like she's been through something that she's really struggled with, how you take that forward with you. But the first thing I'd do is, I'd write about it.
If you want to know about opportunities to send in questions for upcoming guests, then you can follow us on Instagram or Twitter at goodinfluencegs, or you can email the podcast at goodinfluencepod@gmail.com. Before you go, I have three things I ask every guest, and so could you please recommend us something to read, something to listen to, and something to watch?
Okay, so my something to read is a book called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. Some of your readers may have heard about that, but he was a Jewish psychiatrist who survived the concentration camps, and he talks about how people found meaning in those experiences. Mm-hmm. And it's a very short book. It sounds much heavier than it is. It's actually really, it's moving and it gives hope. And it's about how even in the worst circumstances you can possibly imagine, you're mm-hmm. still in control of how you show your values. And I think it's a really valuable book. So I would read that.
Thank you.
Okay, my thing to listen to is, I guess I sort of go on and off with podcasts. But one podcast I do like, and I think they do this well, talking about mental health things, is Glennon Doyle's We Can Do Hard Things.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that there's always an episode there that she brings a really personal element to it of her own vulnerabilities, but also it's very, very funny. And her honesty is very funny. She does it with her wife, who is a very famous footballer, which is also why I like it. So I would recommend that. And then the thing to watch is Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the thing to watch, because I really... So Ferris Bueller's Day Off, as most people who've... Maybe there are people who haven't watched it, in which case, where have you been? But it's about a high school boy. He's 17. He bunks off school, and he's in real trouble if he's going to get caught. And he's got a friend who's in... incredibly anxious. He convinces him to bunk off school for the day. Mm-hmm. And I really want to believe I'm Ferris, but actually I think I might be the anxious friend.
Oh, I'm always the anxious friend in any example.
I know. I want to sort of think I'm Phoebe or Rachel in Friends, but I'm Monica running around with coasters and putting lids on pens. But it's just he's got a great line in there, which is life moves pretty fast. And if you don't stop and look around once in a while, you'll miss it. Mm-hmm. And I just love it. It's a sort of, it's his life in a day, and it's sort of really brilliant. And I think when you're feeling stressed, that's quite a great film to go to.
Thank you for listening, and thank you so much, Sam, for joining me. If you enjoyed the episode, I would love you to subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you're using. And if you're feeling extra generous, leave us a rating and a review as well. See you next week.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.